this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey everybody, welcome back for another episode of Y'allitics. It's just two of us today, myself and our guest, because Jason Whiteley, I mean, if somebody sees him, give us a call. Don't know what happened to him. Maybe it was too early for him to record today, but he is not with us. Actually, he's attending a luncheon today. He says it's work-related, but who knows if that's true. But we'll have him back with us next week unless he finds some other thing to get into. But we have a really great episode today because, you know, we've all been watching very closely what's been going on out in California these past several weeks. It's just been total devastation out there. And we thought that we should bring in someone to talk about this here in Texas because we've got our own issues here, our own risks here when it comes to wildfires. And we have one of the great minds here in Texas who's been doing this for almost a quarter of a century. That sounds like a lot.
Sounds like a whole lot.
Maybe I'll just say 24 years. That sounds better than
that's
a quarter
a little better.
Of a century.
Yeah, that's a little better, Jason.
Wes Moorhead is with us. He is the Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer for Texas A&M Forest Service. Long title there, but you know, basically you've got a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. You oversee the agency's emergency response and natural resource divisions. And you know, a lot of people may not know this here in Texas, but Texas A&M, the Forest Service there, is the lead agency for response to wildfires here in this state, wherever they break out in this state, which seems like a really big job.
It's a big job because it's a big state. Yeah. And there's some nook or cranny in the state that's always burning. You know, some place is always hot and dry and ready to burn.
And when that happens, you know, we hope that it is away from structures, away from populations, you know, because wildfire is, you know, just a part of nature. But unfortunately, you know, we're inhabiting more and more of this state, and a lot of times there are things that are under threat. Just so people know, in that, and I hate to say it again, quarter of a century that you've been doing this, you know, you haven't just been in some cozy office there in College Station, you know, monitoring things from headquarters and kind of giving orders over the radio or a cell phone. You've been out in the thick of this.
That's right. You know, I started the agency 24 years ago, as you highlighted, in the field, as a firefighter, as a forester, day in and day out, managing the natural resources in the state and fighting wildfire, really across the state. Mm-hmm. One cool thing about our agency is that we mobilize resources all around the state.
So y'all got pre-positioned people.
We do.
People.
Yeah, we've got 38 offices across the state that have fire suppression resources staged at them. So we're never too far away from a wildfire ignition.
Mm-hmm. And you stayed in it for a long time. You know, when we first met and we were chatting, you know, you've been in management for a while. And I was thinking, you know, you probably gave several years, 5 years, whatever, because it's rough work out there. You stayed out in the field fighting fires to varying degrees for two decades.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's, Jason, that's why I've got these crow's feet. That's why these wrinkles. That's why I'm looking my age, is because I did spend a lot of time in the field fighting fire in the state and really across the nation.
And we've talked about some of these years. I mean, I know that 2022 here was a pretty terrible year, but there have been years where you've been out there and, I mean, you're just getting calls. It's one after another, depending on what weather conditions are like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when you look at the ecosystems across Texas, they were designed with fire as a component. They burn forever, well before we inhabited this great state. Mm-hmm. And now that we got people out there on the landscape, when we get one of those ignitions or get a fire start, people are immediately threatened. And so we work hand in glove with the local responders to suppress those. And like I said earlier, there's always some place in Texas that mm-hmm. is burning.
You know, we call these wildfires or forest fires. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know that that's the term, but it's almost like, do we need a new term here? Because so often, you know, especially as we grow and develop here in Texas, wildfires, you know, you think of those as being way out there somewhere. These are now ex-urban, suburban, urban in some cases. These aren't some distant, far off, you know, conflagrations that are happening. I mean, it's in people's backyards, it's in people's homes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the distinction from a wildfire between that and a structure fire is simply a structure fire is a home, a commercial building, some developed piece of property that is on fire. A wildland fire is burning in the wildscapes of the state. Mm-hmm. Now that urban area and those wildlands, man, they're intermingled today. We call it the wildland urban interface. It's where the undeveloped meets the developed. And today we're at 31 million Texans now, and they have built out into that WUI, that wildland urban interface, like never before. Mm-hmm. And so we've got folks, we've got homes, we've got businesses exposed to the wildland fuels. So you're exactly right. What used to be maybe a rural issue, those wildfires happen out there, out yonder. Mm-hmm. Now it's in people's backyards.
Out yonder. Boy, you've been out in the sticks a lot here in Texas. That's said a lot out there. That is a good point, though, because I think that, you know, as we develop, I mean, you know, to the layperson, like for instance, I was just down in the Houston area where I'm from over the weekend, and we were driving back. And I mean, when you really start to get down in some of these places that you haven't visited in a while, I hear it from my family all the time, like you'd wait too long to come down. I mean, you look around, and I mean, the growth, even since you were there last, which really wasn't that long ago to my family out there, it's stunning how fast, you know, this is exploding. You see these huge stands of trees that have been cleared out, and there's a new, you know, subdivision going in. I was, you know, driving through Huntsville, saw some things there like that, and Montgomery County. I mean, just the explosion of growth out into these wildlands, as you're talking about. How big of a threat is that as we go further and further out and put our homes and businesses right next to what is essentially fuel in a wildfire situation?
Yeah, exactly right. You mentioned earlier that all the ecosystems in Texas, they have had fire as a natural component. And so that fire is going to continue to be there. That risk of fire is going to be there. We just happen to have houses out there associated with it now and intermingled in it. Our stats say over 85% of the wildfire starts in the state or within 2 miles of a community. Mm. So it's no longer that that rural issue like I mentioned earlier. It's affecting communities. It's affecting homeowners when we see ignition on the landscape.
So we've all been watching what's been going on in California, particularly with the Pacific Palisades neighborhood, which, you know, before all of this happened, I think most people would never conceive that that was going to happen to that neighborhood. Beautiful area of Los Angeles. I mean, you're in the city there. And, you know, they had their own, you know, odd situations going on, especially with that wind, which was just unbelievable, those Santa Ana winds. But I'm curious, how closely do you all watch what's going on over there? Because I think a lot of us have been watching it, but I would imagine that being in your line of work, you're really studying what's going on there. And obviously, they've got their own topography, they've got their own wind situations that are a little unique and so forth. But, you know, this isn't one of those things that absolutely couldn't happen here. So I'm curious how closely you guys watch that.
I watch it very closely. And that last comment about it absolutely could happen here, it has. You know, the Bastrop Complex in 2011 burned 1,660 homes, very devastating wildfire. So we've seen that level of wildfire right here in Texas. But to your original question, we monitor it very close for a couple of reasons. One, our firefighters go out there and help. So currently we've got over 100 Texas firefighters, 25 engines, fire suppression engines out there helping California. That request was made from the state of California to Governor Greg Abbott, and he obliged and sent resources out there. So we're acutely aware of what is going on across the nation because we may send firefighters. We also monitor wildfire across the nation because we learn from those wildfires. Mm-hmm. After every large wildfire, there's an after-action review, an AAR, and it highlights what worked, what didn't, what can we learn from that. And so we're constantly watching for those AARs to see how we can improve our fire response here in Texas based on others' responses.
Is there anything that jumps out at you in the beginnings, though, before you get to those reports where you go, we should, you know, at least start thinking about this, or we should maybe, you know, make some tweaks to our own fire plan because of what I'm seeing happening, let's say in Los Angeles right now with this devastating fire that we've seen. Are there any early indications where you go, that's something to put a pin in?
Yeah, and on the California wildfires that are happening right now, it's the weather. Mm-hmm. And it's those strong Santa Ana winds, which you referenced just a minute ago. We are dialed in on that and watching that because we've got some of the same strong winds that hit us in the panhandle. And so watching how those winds impact the fire behavior and in which direction or routes the fires take, it's something we are dialed in on and constantly trying to figure out what worked, what didn't, and their response efforts related to those really high sustained winds.
Now, what kinds of things are you able to tweak? Like, let's say after the Bastrop Complex fire, as you mentioned back in 2011, that was just an absolute monster. I was out there actually covering that fire. I was working in Austin at the time. And it was unbelievable to see how fast it was going. Yeah. And I mean, people were scrambling to get away, and some of them didn't make it. I mean, it happens in a moment, and you have almost no time to get out. Were there learnings that came out of that? Like, what kinds of things coming out of that as a firefighting agency do you all go, okay, we gotta fix or change or plan for this and this and this?
Yeah, in that Bastrop complex, there were two fatalities on that fire. But on that fire, some of the lessons learned from previous fires were implemented. In 2006, the Amarillo complex burned a little over 900,000 acres, 12 lives lost on that fire. And what we learned from that fire and what we used in the Bastrop complex, what we've used in subsequent fires like Smokehouse Creek, is a focus on evacuation. So there will be days when you simply cannot suppress the wildfire. The firefighters on the ground, despite all their efforts, despite any resource they may apply to it, simply cannot put the fire out. The environmental conditions are such that fire is just gonna move and evade every suppression tactic that we can use. And in that case, we go on the defensive. We're no longer offensively trying to suppress that wildfire. We're on the defensive, moving people out of the way. And so although two fatalities did occur on Bastrop, and that's too many, I can't help but think a lot more lives could have been lost if focus was not put on evacuation, which was done then.
That's an interesting point. And so what you learned from the panhandle prior to that, you went, okay, listen, it's great to get in there and start attacking the flames, but let that be for a minute, and we're going to make sure that we're really doubling down on getting people out of here before we even really lunge into that too much.
That's exactly right. You know, every firefighter, they do not want to lose a structure, but more so they do not want to lose a single person. And so that's been the focus now on these larger wildfires, just get people out of the way and then refocus attention on homes to protect them. But first is people.
I want to talk about some of the threats that are out there, because I pulled up some info here, and you all put out information about this as well, just about how many homes and areas could be at risk here in Texas. And I think a lot of people don't really understand this fully. I didn't until I started looking at this, and I thought, wow, these stats are enormous, you know. So it says 62% of the state's population and housing are at risk of direct or indirect exposure to wildfires. That's a huge percentage,
yeah.
62%.
Jaw-dropping, absolutely. But like, we'll come back to the comments we made earlier about living in that wild and urban interface. I mean, our growth, our explosive growth, the over 500,000 people that are moving to the state every year, they're building into that wild and urban interface. So it does put them at risk.
Mm-hmm. And then I was looking at CoreLogic. They had a 2024 report that came out where they, you know, assess how many homes are at risk in different areas, and they looked at the number of homes at moderate or greater risk. So this is a pretty substantial risk here, and they found 244,617 homes in Texas looked like they're at risk of moderate or greater risk of fires here, and that's only third to California and Colorado. And I think a lot of people here may not realize that. And specifically, they honed in on Austin and San Antonio in the, you know, hill country and right out of the hill country there. They found that Austin had the fifth most homes at moderate or greater risk, and San Antonio had the seventh most. And all others in the top seven were California cities. I mean, that's something when you start landing in there with these California cities, because California, of course, is the most prone to these wildfires, but it really gives you an idea of the threat level, especially in the Austin and San Antonio areas. Can you talk a little bit about why that is for those areas in particular?
Yeah, you bet. And there's definitely hazard there in Austin, San Antonio, but we have hazards throughout the state. Panhandle is a good example. Big fires there. East Texas has big fires. But to dial in on San Antonio and Austin, those fuels are combustible. It's beautiful. That hill country is just beautiful, and people migrate there because of that, because they like that topography, because they like that vegetation type. But it is flammable, unfortunately, and we have had a long history of a lot of wildfire in that area. And so if you're moving into that area, and Austin's being very proactive on this, there are there are different practices that you can employ to kind of protect your piece of Texas, make your home as invincible as possible, although no home is completely invincible to wildfire. There are definitely tactics that you can employ to try to make it a little more fire wise, if you will.
You know, we heard a lot of that here in the past couple of weeks in California going forward. I mean, they've had entire communities, entire neighborhoods that have just been wiped out. And we've heard a lot about how, you know, they're going to really look into the possibility of changing the way neighborhoods are built. Is that something that we are, I mean, you know, if we'll see it there, perhaps, yeah. Is that something that going forward we're more and more likely to see in,
yeah.
in communities?
We see it, it's interesting, we see it in spurts in Texas. So after a large fire, after a fire impacts a community, we see a lot of interest in trying to make that community more resilient to wildfire. And so we see actions on the ground. But then, you know, we're human and something else takes our attention, 3 or 4 months pass and we're on to the next big thing and we kind of forget about those actions that we were taking. Mm. We have some great communities that have taken a proactive approach and we've seen the fruits of that labor. One, for instance, is the Trails fire we had just a couple years ago, Trails of Horseshoe Bay in Llano County. They had a 400-acre fire that burned through that community. Mm. That community is a FireWise community and had been a FireWise community for 17 years at that point. FireWise is a National Fire Protection Association recognition program where it recognizes communities that have taken proactive actions to make their community more fire resilient. Mm-hmm. And the Trails community had done that. Mm. And as that fire entered in, they had homes immediately at risk. And it's interesting, if you do a postmortem on that and you look at that fire perimeter, 400 acres burned, 40 homes were inside that fire perimeter. That means 40 homes were within that burn shed, and they survived. Hmm. They did lose 2 homes in an adjacent community, but that Trails community survived that because of the action they had taken ahead of time, before the fire actually impacted their community.
So how did those homes not burn then? What was the magic in that?
Yeah, the magic, the secret sauce in that is simply the actions they took beforehand. Things as easy as keeping the grass mowed down low, limbing up trees. If you can limb up trees to about 10 foot of height, prune those trees up, it allows, if a fire does come, it allows it to go under the tree and not actually get up into the tree. We call that a ladder fuel. If it goes up into the tree, it's more prone to shed embers, which are just burning pieces of material onto homes and ignite the homes. They've also implemented a trail system that they doubled as a fire break. And so they had a network of trails through that community that served as fire breaks to slow the progression of fire.
So this is probably like a wider trail than a normal trail we'd see in a neighborhood.
Exactly. And every year they cleaned off that trail, you know, removed the debris, pruned up the trees, and made it where it actually was able to slow down the fire as it progressed. And some of those actions I mentioned around the home, there's that grass mowing, the pruning up trees, removing leaves from the gutter, those kind of actions allow a safer environment for firefighters to work too. Hmm. So what we saw on the trails were firefighting personnel were able to get in stage around houses because they had places to work, and they were able to defend those houses much more effectively than other neighborhoods.
These sound like little things. I mean, in some cases, like removing the leaves from the gutters, like that doesn't sound like it would be this huge help. In keeping an explosive situation from becoming a lot worse.
It is. But Jason, like you and I, we get busy. And there's leaves probably in our gutter today.
Oh, yeah, there definitely are in my house, yeah.
And it's something you got to do year in and year out. So as soon as those leaves are shed, you've got to get there. We've got to get up there this weekend and clean out those gutters.
Yeah, thanks for putting that on the to-do list. But, you know, maybe it needed to be done. And I suppose that is just because if you were in a situation where a fire is burning near your neighborhood, these embers can go quite a ways, by the way.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've been seeing that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's not uncommon for them to go to a quarter of a mile, for the embers to loft up a quarter of a mile. And so you want to try to make your house as non-receptive to ignition or spark as possible.
So when that ember, let's say one of those lands on your roof, if it lands on a shingle, it might just sort of flame out and be done.
Right.
If it lands in that pile of leaves that I still haven't cleared out from last year and maybe the year before, you
much
might be
more
looking
receptive.
At a bad situation.
Absolutely right.
Interesting. Yeah. So the tiny things. So it almost sounds like this place in Llano County was a case study.
It is. If you go on our website, you can actually read the details on that particular fire, the Trails fire in Llano County, and it'll highlight the successes that they experienced.
Now, as somebody who's been in this for a long time, is that one of those things where you look at that, the after action report, and you you kind of go, the light bulb goes off.
It's one of those things you look at and you say to yourself, well, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That worked.
I've been yelling this from the mountaintops for a long time. Yeah,
exactly. That works. Now, with that said, I mean, you can take these actions ahead of time, and it's no guarantee. You know, nothing is guaranteed. Mother Nature is going to do what Mother Nature does, but these actions definitely make a difference.
Is that one of those things, though, that other cities, pay attention to as well, or that you direct people to? You know, like, oh, you're thinking of putting in a big development. Look at this. This could help you plan.
You bet, because not only that stuff that you do in and around your yard, but the building composition matters too. So if you've got a new development, that's perfect time to implement some building practices that'll make the whole community more fire resilient, using building components that are less apt to ignite under adverse conditions.
Can you talk a little bit about, again, going back to California and specifically, talking about places in Texas like an Austin or a San Antonio? I remember back when I was working in Austin and speaking to some folks in the firefighting business. I hate to call it a business, but who are firefighters, and they were talking about their nightmare being the hills just west of downtown. I mean, they spill right down into downtown Austin, and that was their biggest worry, was that they would get a bad fire going in those hills during a drought time, and that the winds would be blowing. And they said, if that were to happen, all bets are off. Like, we would, really be stretched to keep that from becoming a real danger, especially if those winds were coming into the city. Is that one of those scenarios that, you might lay there at night thinking about, or is there a couple of particular scenarios here in Texas that really pull on your mind?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so I know that does keep people in Austin, the planners in Austin, up at night. Absolutely. Hills create some issues for suppression, right? You can't get equipment in as easy, manpower in as easy to suppress those fires. So anytime you've got terrain like that, it makes it a little more complicated for suppression. It's also harder to get engines in and around when you're looking at that topography. And that vegetation type, as mentioned earlier, will definitely burn, so it's combustible. But not only in Austin, but let's take the Panhandle, that sea of endless grass. If you've been up there lately and you look at the horizon, it's just grass as far as you can see. That, under the right conditions with a strong wind, can really move a wildfire very rapidly.
And those winds are always blowing in the
Panhandle. Winds are blowing. On Smokehouse Creek, we had strong winds, 60 mile an hour winds, and we saw that fire actually traverse 95 miles in just under 30 hours. So it was just moving across the landscape. So not only Austin, San Antonio, Panhandle, but we also see problematic fires in East Texas, in the Piney Woods of East Texas. Got a beautiful forest in East Texas, and people love to live in and amongst it. But those woods, those Piney Woods, are really just fuel for the fire if they're not managed appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And those come, as I was just saying, right down into places like Huntsville, even, Houston, Conroe, all those areas. And so that's another area of real concern. These are places that you might think of when you're laying there like, what can we do better? How can we prepare for this more?
That's exactly right. We all love to live in and amongst vegetation. We all love to live in amongst nature. But when you live amongst nature, you're at risk. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I was looking at y'all's stats on the problems that you all have prevented over the years. And this is pretty staggering, too. And again, I think it gives an idea of how much all of us are at risk of this sort of thing. It was saying between 2005 and 2021, you all and local fire departments responded to 218,351 wildfires. That's stunning when you think about it, burning 11.8 million acres. But in that time, it says here that you all were able to save approximately 130, almost 132,000 homes over those years. And these would be homes that were probably in direct threat of these fires. This really gives an indication of A, how serious the problem is here in Texas, and B, how widespread it is.
Absolutely. Those numbers are staggering. And so if you do the math on that, we're experiencing some 7,000 wildfires annually in the state of Texas. Now, they may only be a 5-acre or a 10-acre or a 20-acre wildfire. It has little impact initially. The local responders are able to respond to that, and the local fire department, Dallas Fire Department today, would put that out. No issue, no harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have fires that grow to 100 acres and impact multiple homes, maybe even see home loss. And so those numbers are big, and It's a big state, and so like I mentioned earlier, it's going to burn at some point. And so we're always preparing for and making sure we've got resources available to help suppress those wildfires.
Can you tell me over the years, you know, again, 24 years in this, 20 of those, you know, out in the field actively fighting these fires, have you had situations either then or in management when, you know, you guys were able to contain it and get a handle on it, but if one tiny little thing would have gone differently, it would have just run roughshod for much longer? I mean, I think a lot of us in our different jobs get to the end of the day, I know I do, where you go, well, it turned out well. Boy, that could have been a disaster. It was this close and nobody's ever gonna know that, but I know that.
Yeah.
I would imagine that you've seen that a number of times where you think, man, all it would have taken is one tiny little thing and I know what that thing was and this would have just been horrible.
Absolutely, by the skin of your teeth, right? Yeah. Just by that margin, absolutely. After every fire, whether it's a 5-acre fire or a 5,000 acre fire, we have a after action review I mentioned earlier, and that's where we kind of war game out what happened, what worked, what didn't work. On the smaller fires, we'll call it a tailgate session. We'll drop the tailgate, get all the firefighters in, what worked, what didn't. And often we'll find out, okay, that worked, but it's only because X, Y, Z. It's only because we caught that at the nick of time before it got into that next pasture. We caught that before it entered into that 100-acre stand of timber. And so absolutely, there's always things that we're learning from every size fire that we'll then try to replicate and learn from on the next one.
Yeah, and hopefully it prevents even fires from happening. You know, one of the odd things here is, you know, we don't have as much, you know, for instance, federal land, you know, which might be managed differently. I think you guys estimate that in Texas, 95% of the land is privately owned and managed. Does that present some difficulties, though? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of these landowners, they don't want anybody telling them how to manage their property. They don't want anybody on their property. You know, but their property is adjacent to other things, and if something happens on their property, boom, you've got a bad situation on your hands. How do you convince them, like, hey, let's try to keep these, you know, things mowed, let's try to get this thing trimmed up, let's get you, you know, a little bit more, you know, fire ready?
Yeah, the awesome thing about Texas is it is a private property state, right? 95% privately held. Yous and me's of the world own that piece of Texas, but we can do what we want with it for the most part. There may be HOA, you know, restrictions, there may be some county or municipal restrictions, but for the most part, that's our piece of property. And if we want the grass to grow up 4 feet tall, we can let it. If we want to not prune up the trees, we can let it. If we want it to totally encroach right up to the house and have as much brush as possible, we can do it. Mm-hmm. That does complicate things for firefighters. We know best practices that work. It's been proven time and time again, these practices work, but you've got to convince people, you got to convince communities that it's worth the time, it's worth the effort, and get them kind of, you know, off the rocking chair, off the couch, and actually go do something about it. Mm-hmm. So it does create, you know, a different dynamic in Texas, having so many privately held pieces of Texas that everybody can do what they want on their piece, and it does complicate things.
I saved the best part for last. Now we get to talk about the politics of it all. So Texas has grown tremendously, as you pointed out. You know, roughly 31 million people now. We're, you know, developing into every corner of the state here. Have you all grown, though, as the, you know, the premier firefighting service that's supposed to, you know, watch over this and make sure that it doesn't all go up in flames?
Yeah, you know, we've been around since 1915, so we've been around 110 years as an agency. We were primarily an East Texas agency in the origins of our agency, and it wasn't until the mid-90s that we began to go out to Central and West Texas and build out, and the legislature has continued to invest in us over time to grow the agency, to be able to respond to the more problematic wildfires we're seeing today, and so we've had some great investments by the lawmakers in Austin, and we'll look forward to some continued investments. We've got a couple requests in this session that are being explored. One of those requests is for aviation resources. An interesting note on aviation, it can be a game changer. It's an awesome tool to have in the arsenal.
We've been seeing that in California.
Absolutely seeing it in California. We see it here in Texas every year. We'll have aircraft come in, drop water, drop retardant. Huge asset to have on the wildland fire scene. But we don't actually own any fixed wing aviation aircraft in Texas. We have a little bit of a complicated process to access those through our federal partners. So the United States Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, they maintain a fleet of fire suppression aircraft or contracts with fire suppression aircraft, and we can utilize those through our partners, through our federal partners, if they're not using them. Hmm. And so that system's worked to some extent in the past, but now their competition's really, really high for those assets. Mm-hmm. And we see it in California now, where California's got a lot of those. If Texas needed them, we may or may not be able to access those through the federal system. So one of our asks is for Austin to consider, what does it look like for Texas to own or at least directly contract with fire suppression and fire supervision aircraft, so that we continue to have that tool in the toolbox, mm-hmm. and we're never without, because we couldn't access them.
That's an interesting point, and I honed right in when you said if they are accessible. We're seeing so many of these states, though, that are having these unprecedented fire risks, just like, you know, here in Texas, and on any given fire, you may or may not be able to get those aircraft. And I think we saw pretty starkly in California, we're seeing in real time how important that is, because there were days when they couldn't fly those helicopters or airplanes because the wind was just howling, 100 mile an hour winds, you know, you're not putting up the choppers in that. But boy, when they were able to get those in the air, a couple of days later, bam, suddenly you're able to start actually knocking this fire down. I mean, you see what a difference it makes.
Absolutely. Yeah, and aircraft have limitations, as you just highlighted. When the winds are high, they can't fly, can't safely fly, can't effectively drop retardant. Retardant comes out of the belly of the plane and it shifts off site because the wind blows it. So there are limitations. But when they can be employed, they are a game changer and extremely beneficial. You know, you mentioned earlier about me being out on the fire line for the good chunk of my career. And the absolute worst thing you want to hear as an instant commander on the fire line is that an aviation asset was UTF'd, unable to fill. Mm. Radio dispatch, dispatch will radio in and say, aircraft UTF'd. You know you're not getting an airplane on your fire, and
you deflate.
That's definitely a letdown, and that's just because there's only a limited supply of those aircraft, and when you're competing nationally for them, it's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough sometimes to get them.
Are drones in that too, or is that a thought?
Yeah, drones are definitely developing. So currently, there's no drone that has the payload capacity to drop a water retardant, but they're in development right now. So that could be a thing in the future for sure.
How long do you think it is before we see something like that, roughly?
I know they're testing it now, and you've got different manufacturers playing around with how can they increase capacity, how can they safely work over a fire scene. So hopefully in the next 5, 6, 7 years,
so
you'll
changing.
Start to see those. Absolutely changing fast.
Yeah, I was wondering about that during the California fires when they couldn't put pilots up and so forth. I was wondering, how long before we see drones going up and attempting, in some of those dicier situations? So you've got this request before the legislature. How much money are we talking about here?
The thing with aviation is it's big dollars.
Yeah, it's not cheap.
Yeah, it is big money. And so it's one that, we don't take lightly. It's one that we're looking forward to the conversation to have to see what looks right for Texas. With that said, in aviation world, we pay for it whether we're contracting through the federal system or
True.
We contract directly with them. So right now, if we order in a large air tanker today, if it was filled by the national system, we got it in Texas, we would pay for that. Texas would pay for that. We pay for it in arrears. So we actually owe the U.S. Forest Service money for that tank, and we pay them the next legislative session. We're talking about, should we start paying ahead of time? Should we go ahead and contract direct with that large air tanker so that it's in Texas, day of fire, and not waiting for it to run through the national system to come to Texas? Pay for it ahead of time and not in arrears.
Is there a figure on this at this point?
Yeah, the current legislative appropriation request is over $350 million mm-hmm. for consideration, and that's a combination of both purchasing aircraft and contracting direct with vendors to supply other aircraft.
And have you gotten any early indications, any discussions in the early going here?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest, and I think
You didn't get a no right out of the box. That's good.
Yeah, they didn't tell us to go pound sand. That's exactly right. And I think it's because it is so important, and the lawmakers in Austin have seen the benefit of having aircraft and allowing Texas to take care of its own and not waiting on the federal system to allow us access to aircraft. Now, with that said, I did want to highlight aircraft are not the end all be all. Right, we did mention limitations when it comes to wind speeds and different things. And so in our world, you're looking at a three-legged stool. You've got aviation as one critical leg, and we want to make sure we have that tool in the toolbox. But we also want to make sure we've got firefighters on the ground. And so another ask that we've got in is for the state to consider increasing the state firefighting resources to put more equipment and personnel on the ground to combat these challenging wildfires. Mm. And the last leg of that stool is for additional money for our cooperators. When you look across Texas, there's over 1,800 local fire departments, and these men and women are first responders. They're the first on the scene. They're highly effective at suppressing wildfire. About 9 out of 10 wildfires are suppressed at that local level. So Dallas will roll out today on a grass fire, suppress it. No state resources apply.
You never
to
get
it.
A call.
Never yeah. get a call. Never hear about it. You know, and so that's what we'd love to see. We want to continue to invest in those local resources so that they have the equipment, the training, the necessary PPE to suppress those wildland fires without state assistance.
So let's talk about leg two and leg three of that stool. Then, what's our number on that?
So let's go leg two, which is investment in state resources, putting more state firefighters on the ground with more equipment. Leg two would be around 30,000, just shy of 30. I mean, I wish that
if
was
only,
case.
God.
Yeah, if only.
I was 30 like, wow, million. That's a bargain. Yeah.
You'd go and write me a check today for that. No, 30
sure.
million, which you could
out
probably
Jason
still write
Whiteley's
me a check.
Checkbook, yeah.
30 million for the biennium to allow purchase of firefighting equipment and more state responders on staff so they're ready to respond to requests for local assistance. And those local responders, like I said, 9 out of 10 times, they're extremely effective. They don't need state resources, but when they need state resources, they need them in a bad way. They need the specialized equipment that Texas A&M Forcers brings in the form of bulldozers, motor graders, and those air tankers. That's what we bring to the game.
So let's talk about leg three.
Leg three.
What's that number?
Yeah, that's our capacity building program, and we want to augment that with an additional $22 million. Not terrible
right.
per year. And so that would allow grants to be given to our cooperators. When you look at the 1,800 fire departments out there, almost 1,300 of them are volunteer fire departments. Mm.
And so overall here, you're looking at, you know, roughly close to $400 million total that you all are asking for. Two things really going in your favor here, though. A, you got this huge budget surplus again in this legislative session. Of course, you know, we talk about huge budget surpluses. I'm sure they've spent it about 10 different ways already, you know, in their minds anyway. But the other thing I think that really helps you guys, and correct me if I'm wrong here, they're seeing what's happening in California as well. How pivotal do you think it is that has all happened in conjunction with the beginning of a legislative session? I mean, the timing there, just to really bring to mind, because as you said, you know, we get 3 months after a big event and we've moved on to something else. They're seeing this in real time as they're taking up y'all's requests.
Yeah, it does underscore like the value of having assets ready to deploy on a fire line. It does underscore how catastrophic a wildfire can be and how it can impact a state. But a lot of these lawmakers, a lot of the legislators, they've experienced it firsthand. Mm. You know, over the last several years in their home districts, they've experienced wildfire. So it's been on their mind, and like you just highlighted, you know, a couple months go by and we're on to the next thing. But it has impacted them. You know, visiting with them one-on-one, you can see that they recall the impact that had on the community. Because you have a wildfire burn into a community, not only you got homes lost, but you've got economies disrupted, mm-hmm. and it's a long-term thing. So the yous and me's of the world, as we see it on TV, in 3 months we may pivot onto something else. But those lawmakers in their district, they're seeing it, and they're still seeing the scars from those wildfires.
It's different
today.
When you've lived it.
Absolutely.
But have some of them mentioned what's happening in California, though? Is that top of their mind when they're talking to you guys?
Absolutely. And they want to draw parallels, just like you did, of can that happen here? Have we seen that here?
So they've been asking you that.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very interested in that.
Mm. And you've told them.
Yeah, and you know, we can highlight the Smokehouse Creek. That's still on everybody's mind. A million acres burning in just under 30 hours. That's impactful.
So you've told them, yeah, it can happen here, and it has happened here.
It has happened here, yeah. You know, in my experience, the legislature has been very proactive in allocating resources appropriately when it comes to emergency response. I'm not saying that they'll choose to invest in this and our ask this year, but historically, they've been made investments in the agency to make sure we are ready for the next wildfire.
Well, I think some people would be surprised in this state, and maybe even some of these incoming lawmakers in particular, that we don't have our own fleet of air tankers and so forth, or we don't have a dedicated one.
Yeah, absolutely right. And a lot of people, they see the tankers in there, they see the planes in there, and just assume That's the State of Texas Resources, and glad to have it. And
you're like,
and
I wish it was.
I wish it was. I wish it was that easy. Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk through this with us. And you know, hopefully this at least puts things top of mind for people. I mean, you know, even what you do in your own yard makes a difference, or on your own property makes a difference. But don't forget about these people who are all around the state, who have, you know, resources in place, who are, you know, always on call. I saw you, you know, before this, you know, podcast started, and, you know, you've got two phones over there. You never know when that thing's going to ring, but you've got it with you all the time, and you just never know.
It's a 24/7 job. Absolutely right.
Well, Wes Moorhead, Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer for the Texas A&M Forest Service, thanks again for being with us today.
Absolutely, Jason. Thanks for having me.
And if anybody out there sees Jason Whiteley, let us know. We're yolitics@wfaa.com. Send us feedback there. Send us ideas there. We're always glad to hear from you, and hopefully we find him by the time we get to next week.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV. And watch the latest episode of Yolitics,